This is edition number 2031 of The Mardler, recorded in Aylsham on Friday the 21st of August 2026. Hello, you're listening to The Mardler, the weekly talking newspaper for North Norfolk. Today we bring you the week's news and views from the North Norfolk News of Thursday the 20th of August. My name is Debs Hall and my fellow readers are
Mary Wilson,
Simon Musto-Arthur
and Dorry Brecken.
On the notice board today, this week the sun will rise around 5:50 and will set at about 8:05.
The magazine supplement will follow a little later in the programme and includes the reality and myths of a solar eclipse, trekking and tracking in the shade of an African rainforest, throwing some light on the sounds made by birds, and an enlightened bookworm's visit to a National Trust properties library, as well as a recorded interview with the general manager of Cromer Pier.
But we begin with the main news items, which include the naming of a man trampled at Felbrigg Hall, the impact of the prolonged dry weather in the region, a company's £1,500 loss after a failed offline payment machine, and controversy around the appointment of Norfolk County Council's new £215,000 a year top officer. Let's start with those lead stories.
A catering business from Norfolk could be more than £1,500 out of pocket after all card payments taken at a village fair apparently failed to go through. Contemporary Catering Company based in Walsingham was serving pizzas at Langham Street Fair on Saturday, August 15th, when it switched to taking payments offline because of connectivity problems. But when staff later connected the card reader to Wi-Fi, every transaction was later declined, even though it said it had approved, the business said. The company believes it is now owed more than £1,500 from the event at Langham near Holt and is appealing for anyone who bought a pizza by card to check their bank account and get in touch if the payment has not left their account. A spokeswoman said, "We had 55 card transactions and none of them went through." They said some customers' banks showed a pending transaction, while in other cases the payment appeared to have disappeared completely. The problem was only discovered after the event, when their card payment details were showing as zero. The firm said it had used the same card reader for 4 years without previous issues. Square, the company which owns the card reader, has UK guidance which says businesses accepting payments offline are responsible for cards which later decline, expire, or are disputed. We put 2 days of work into the fair with all the preparation needed, bringing our own equipment and staffing. It's a huge loss, the spokeswoman added. It's not just about the money, it's all about the hard work put in. The event was really good and we all enjoyed it, so it is such a shame that this has happened. Anyone who paid by card for pizza from Contemporary Catering Company at Langham Street Fair is being urged to check whether the payment has left their bank account and contact the business if it has not.
The man who died after he was trampled by cattle at a National Trust estate in Norfolk has been named. John Orton, 78, was visiting Felbrigg Hall when the tragedy happened on July 13th. His inquest, which opened at Norfolk Coroner's Court on Friday, listed his provisional cause of death as severe chest injuries due to being trampled by cattle. The court also heard he was born on February 3, 1948, lived at St Margaret's Close in Cromer, and was a retired telecoms engineer. Paramedics were called to the scene on the day of the tragedy, but he was pronounced dead in the grounds of the stately home. The National Trust property was then closed while an investigation was launched, before reopening later that week. The Health and Safety Executive, HSE, is leading the investigation, which is still ongoing. Mr. Orton is believed to have been walking on the grounds when the incident occurred. The inquest hearing was told statements have been requested from police officers who attended and investigated the incident, Mr. Orton's GP and the HSE. Assistant Coroner Maeve Sykes adjourned the inquest for a further review at 9:30 a.m. on February the 11th, 2027. The Coroner's Court's support service helps bereaved families and witnesses attending Norfolk's Coroner's Court. If you are a bereaved family member or a witness, please get in touch by calling 0300 111 2141 or emailing helpline at ccss.org.uk.
Norfolk County Council's new £215,000 a year top officer has been appointed, but in controversial circumstances. Concerns about a perceived lack of experience and claims of a rushed process to get him in place led to 18 county councillors opposing the appointment of Dennis Bacon as chief executive at reform-led County Hall. But with 45 councillors backing the decision, Mr. Bacon, a former winner of the TV show Four in a Bed, will next month take the helm at the authority, which has a budget of £2.3 billion. David Bick, reform leader at County Hall, said Mr. Bacon, who spent 19 years as chairman of the Norfolk Independent Care Association, was the best person for the job after a process which attracted 49 applicants. But the Liberal Democrat and Green groups opposed his appointment, while the council's sole Labour councillor questioned Mr. Bacon's record and timing of his resignation as director of care company Apple Home Care. Brian Watkins, leader of the Lib Dem group, said the process has been carried out with undue haste, with barely any time for proper scrutiny. He said Reform's handling of the process had been unacceptable and inexcusable. Green leader Maxine Webb said her group had similar concerns, that the recruitment process was not robust or adequate enough for such a senior appointment. The vacancy of chief executive came about after the sudden resignation of Tom McCabe in June, just over a month after Reform took control of the organisation. Labour councillor Ben Weston said Mr. Bacon had, until June the 30th, a few days after Mr. McCabe quit, been a director of care company Apple Home Care, which provides services to the council. Mr. Weston said the Care Quality Commission's last inspection rated Mr. Bacon's company as requiring improvement, including for its leadership. Mr. Weston questioned whether that made Mr. Bacon suitable for managing an 8,000-strong workforce. Mr. Bick said Mr. Weston's comments were unworthy and it was a shame he had made them in a public place. Conservative Daniel Elmer said he could see that there could be quite refreshing merit in appointing someone from the private sector to the role, but questioned why the process could not have been conducted over a longer time period. But officers confirmed the process had been legal and proper, and John Whedon, Great Yarmouth First leader, said he welcomed Mr. Bacon's appointment. Mr. Bick added, there was a suggestion that the candidate did not have any background in local government. That is not true. I am absolutely convinced that we have got the best person. Mr. Bacon is a past recipient of an Outstanding Leadership in Public Services Award from Norfolk County Council. The 63-year-old, who has served as a member of the Norfolk and Waveney Sustainability and Transformation Partnership, a network of local NHS organisations and councils, is due to begin his job on September the 7th. Last year, he experienced television fame when the 38 St Giles boutique bed and breakfast he runs in Norwich featured on the popular reality show Four in a Bed. The show follows a group of B&B owners as they tour one another's establishments and compete to be voted the best host, with Mr. Bacon's winning.
A lively demonstration has taken place in support of the reopening of an NHS site. Protesters demonstrated outside Benjamin Court in Cromer and in the town centre. The local health facility closed its doors to patients 3 years ago without public consultation. Since June 2023, the facility, which provided step-down care for patients leaving the hospital, has been left empty. The Save Benjamin Court campaign group is urging for the site to be reopened to prevent bed blocking at nearby hospitals. One campaigner said, "Reopening Benjamin Court as a healthcare facility will be a vitally needed resource in North Norfolk, reduce crippling delayed charges from Norfolk and Norwich University Hospitals NHS Foundation Trust, and provide an excellent unit to prevent hospital readmissions. It's a large NHS space that's crying out to be used." Around 50 people took part in the demonstration, with passing motorists beeping horns and passers-by expressing their support.
A large blaze broke out on the heath in Kelling near Holt last Thursday afternoon, with several crews called to the scene. Firefighters remained in the area into the evening to dampen down the hotspots, with smoke still billowing across the heath. New images have now emerged from the area showing the significant damage to the heath in Holgate Hill. It was one of several fires that broke out in Norfolk on Thursday, with the Norfolk Fire and Rescue Service declaring a major incident. The service cited significant pressure on resources across the county and said it was prioritising life risk and property. Firefighters were called to a major blaze at Mousehold Heath in Norwich shortly afterwards, while other crews were tackling one at Thomas Bullock Primary Academy in Shipdham. The fire service has urged for the public to only call 999 for genuine emergencies and warned that response times to non-life risk incidents may be delayed. It also told people to avoid lighting bonfires, campfires or disposable barbecues, and to properly dispose of rubbish and cigarettes to reduce the risk of further fires.
The organisers of Cromer Carnival have announced that the firework display, which was supposed to take place today, will no longer go ahead. It comes after a severe alert was issued by the government on Friday evening to millions of people's phones, warning of a high risk of wildfires. A post from the carnival's Facebook account said on Saturday, "Having considered the latest guidance and advice, we have made the responsible decision that the display cannot safely go ahead. We are disappointed that the fireworks cannot go ahead, but we are confident that cancelling them is the right decision in the circumstances. Safety has to come first." It follows the carnival organisers' announcement yesterday, which warned visitors that there was a complete ban on smoking and littering on the carnival grounds and car parks. People online responded asking whether the firework display would be cancelled, but at the time the organisers responded saying it would still go ahead as planned. This sparked backlash among the community, with one commenter claiming it would be irresponsible if they were to go ahead with the display. In the latest announcement, the organisers have addressed the criticism and said, "We appreciate that there has been considerable discussion around why a decision was not made sooner. We want to be clear that we were assessing the situation throughout and making decisions based on the information available to us at the time. Yesterday morning, we did not have the government guidance that has since been issued." The government's severe alert said, "There is a very high risk of wildfires nationally. Residents, visitors and landowners should not undertake any activity that could start a fire, including disposable barbecues, fire pits, garden incinerators or fireworks. Even a small flame can rapidly develop into a major wildfire, placing lives, homes, businesses and emergency workers at risk."
In 1 week last month, Norfolk Fire and Rescue Service tackled more than 60 fires in the open, including 5 wildfires spanning at least 10,000 square metres, which required more than 100 firefighters. It follows months of dry conditions across the region, caused by low rainfall and 4 separate heat waves so far this summer. Norfolk Fire and Rescue said the rising number of call-outs has also added to the ongoing financial pressures on the service, with its budget projected to overrun by more than £1 million for 2026-27. A spokeswoman for the service said, "In July, we recorded 800 more individual fire appliance mobilisations compared to the same period last year. This reflects an increase in total calls, as well as the complexity and duration of incidents, and the need to maintain adequate fire cover across the county while incidents are ongoing. Even when facing high demand, we continue to respond to incidents as quickly and safely as possible, ensuring our communities receive the support they need." Although it has seen high spending this year, Norfolk Fire and Rescue Service still has the third lowest service costs in the country per population size. The county is suffering from flash drought as a result of very low rainfall and high temperatures, the Environment Agency has said. There have been 4 heat waves so far this year, with an amber heat health alert ending at 9 a.m. yesterday, August the 5th. Households across Norfolk have also been banned from using hose pipes since July the 11th. It is understood Anglian Water will not lift the ban until they are confident that river and reservoir levels have improved to a healthy level. However, the company expects dry weather to persist through the summer.
A public meeting on flooding is to take place in a Norfolk Broads village, in which officials will explain how they have been tackling the issue over the last 2 years. Locals from the Hickling area are invited to hear updates from key agencies and raise any concerns they have. Norfolk County Councillor Matthew Taylor, who represents the Stalham Division, has organised the event at Hickling Barn on Friday, September the 25th from 6 p.m. It follows a similar meeting held at the same venue 2 years ago in the aftermath of Storm Babette, which was organised by former North Norfolk MP Duncan Baker. Representatives from major flooding stakeholders are expected to form a panel at the meeting, which will also be live streamed on social media. Organisers said the aim was to update locals on work carried out during the past 2 years to prevent and reduce the impact of flooding, while allowing people to highlight any continuing or new problems. The previous meeting was attended by around 250 people and watched online by more than 20,000 viewers. Mr. Taylor said the meeting 2 years ago, held in the wake of Storm Babette, was about securing action and stronger working relationships between flooding stakeholders in Norfolk. Since that time, significant work has been undertaken by the organisations, but it's right that local residents are informed of what's being done. Henry Cater, chairman of the North Norfolk Strategic Flooding Alliance, said, "Keeping communities informed and helping residents understand what action they could take themselves were critical parts of the response. Storm Babette caused chaos across the region, with roads flooded, land submerged, trees blown over, and schools closed due to heavy rain and gale force winds. The meeting will take place at Hickling Barn, Tate Loke, Mallard Way, Hickling, NR12 0YU.
Our next few news stories involve issues involving celebrity support for a charitable committee. 2 former bosses cleared of fraud but facing court costs of millions of pounds. Closed toilets, scam parcels and local transport issues.
Celebrities from Norfolk have paid tribute to a UK emergency fundraising body after 60 years of service. Sir Stephen Fry, who grew up in Bootin, and Myleene Class from Galston are among the public figures honouring the work of the Disasters Emergency Committee, the DEC, as it marks 6 decades of broadcast appeals and humanitarian impact. The DEC, which brings together 15 UK charities to respond to global crises, has raised more than £2.5 billion through 80 emergency campaigns since 1966. Fry said, "The charities work together and the money gets funneled through straight away. It's a brilliant system and it's worked for 60 years, and I hope it will continue to do so." He fronted the DEC's 2008 appeal following Cyclone Nargis in Myanmar. Myleene Class, a Save the Children ambassador, visited the Philippines after Typhoon Haiyan in 2014. "I think the DEC, 60 years down the line, is just incredible," she said. DEC appeals have been supported by the BBC, ITV, Channel 4 and Sky. Dame Joanna Lumley, Daniel Craig, Sir Lenny Henry, Keira Knightley and Malala Yousafzai have all fronted televised campaigns. It has responded to major crises including the 1983 Ethiopian famine and ongoing conflicts in the Middle East. Saleha Said, Chief Executive of the DEC, added, "I am extremely grateful to the incredibly generous UK public for their long-standing support. As we look to the future and a changing world, DEC appeals continue to make a difference to families in urgent need."
Two former bosses of a psychiatric hospital who lost a High Court bid to sue Norfolk Police over a failed fraud investigation have been ordered to pay costs that could run into the millions. Andrew Brees and Dominic Wilson, who ran Causton Park Hospital near Elsham, were cleared of defrauding £2.5 million by overcharging NHS primary care trusts when a criminal trial collapsed in 2009. The former general manager and finance director subsequently began legal action seeking £30 million in damages from Norfolk Constabulary, accusing them of a malicious prosecution in public office. They claimed the prosecution had been motivated by malice and that officers had suppressed or tampered with evidence in order to try to secure a conviction. However, Mr. Justice Cotter, sitting at the High Court, dismissed their civil litigation last October following a 12-day trial, concluding there had been no deliberate manipulation of the evidence. In a cost judgment, he has now ordered that Mr. Brees, now 71, and Mr. Wilson, 52, must pay indemnity costs incurred by the police in order to defend themselves. The exact amount they are now liable to pay has not been revealed, but the judgment states that both men previously offered to pay £1.1 million each in settlement. The cost dispute centred on a letter sent by solicitors acting on behalf of the Chief Constable in November 2024, inviting the claimants to discontinue their litigation and warning that indemnity costs would be sought. Causton Park Hospital shut in May 2021 after health watchdog the Care Quality Commission found it had consistently failed to meet standards since 2019.
Public toilets across North Norfolk have been forced to close following a spate of vandalism. Damage was reported at facilities in Wells, Fakenham, North Walsham and Cromer, prompting closures and repair efforts. A spokesman for North Norfolk District Council said, "With carnivals across North Norfolk, market events, lots of lovely local events and visitors during the summer holidays, the closure of public conveniences can have a huge impact. The council will work quickly to get these facilities back open for residents and visitors."
Norfolk County Council Trading Standards is raising awareness about a brushing scam in which people receive unsolicited packages. These parcels are not charged to the recipient, but are sent to help sellers post fake reviews. The scam relies on sellers creating fake accounts to buy their own products and leave fake positive reviews, making their goods appear more trustworthy. The more reviews a product has, the more likely people are to buy the goods, as they trust that it will suit their needs.
Gasworks are set to cause weeks of road closures and disruption in a North Norfolk town. Two separate closures in North Walsham, both for gas main replacement works by Cadent, will impact Crow Road and Hall Lane from August the 24th. Hall Lane will be closed from Church Street to Marshgate and on Limetree Road for 10 metres north from its junction with Hall Lane. The diversion route for Hall Lane includes Church Street, Market Place, New Road, Pound Road, Marshgate, Bluebell Road, Backton Road and back to Church Street. For Limetree Road, the diversion will be via Church Street, Market Place, New Road, Pound Road, Marshgate, Bluebell Road, Backton Road, Kimberley Road and Limetree Road. Further disruption is expected on Crow Road, which will be closed from Munsley Road to Backton Road until September the 6th, with a possible extension to October the 18th if works overrun. An alternative route will take drivers via Munsley Road, North Street, Vicarage Street and Backton Road. Those living in Crow Road will still be able to access their homes, but through traffic will be diverted.
Drivers are being warned about a new scam targeting parking app users. Norfolk County Council's Trading Standards Team has issued an alert about fraudulent text messages claiming to be from Ringgo, a mobile parking payment service. The messages typically state there is an outstanding parking payment or an unpaid parking session. A spokesman for the council said, "The text message is fake, sent by fraudsters who want to steal your login credentials, personal and financial information. The messages attempt to trick users into clicking a fraudulent link, which the scammers then use to steal personal and financial information. Trading Standards has advised recipients to forward suspicious messages to 7726 and has also shared several warning signs to help identify the scam. These include messages sent from generic or personal email addresses, suspicious web links, and requests to reply to a letter or copy a link into a browser." The spokesman added, "If you are ever unsure about a payment, you can safely check your official account at any time by opening the official Ringgo app or go directly to the My Ringgo website."
Steam services are returning to North Norfolk on a limited basis after being halted due to wildfire concerns. North Norfolk Railway has confirmed that steam trains will once again run between Sheringham and Weybourne after discussions with Norfolk Fire and Rescue. The Poppy Line had temporarily stopped its scheduled steam haul trains over the weekend after a government alert about the nationwide risk of wildfires. Heritage diesel services continued to operate along the full route between Sheringham and Holt, while a historic steam locomotive ran short shuttle trips at Sheringham. North Norfolk Railway said it was grateful to visitors for their patience while staff put revised operating plans in place. A spokesperson said the railway would continue to liaise with Norfolk Fire and Rescue Service and would issue further updates if arrangements change.
You are listening to edition number 2031 of The Mardler, recorded on Friday, the 21st of August, 2026. Still to come are the early onset of autumn, a snake bite, dying fish, blooming blue-green algae, planning and community matters, and of course, The Mardler magazine. But before all of that, here are some letters to the editor of the North Norfolk News.
J. Ray of Aylsham writes, What is it with the younger generation in this country? Not all of them, but those like the ones who were intent on causing trouble at events, like the ones at Cromer Pier recently, that had to be cancelled by the organisers so that the majority of people couldn't enjoy themselves. I've been to many fiestas in Spain and I haven't seen any trouble. The Spanish kids seem to be so much more civilised. Perhaps it's good advert for conscription, but then do we want to be dependent on these types of people defending us in conflicts?
What price service? Use it or lose it is very much the order of the day when applied to our local high street shops. Money is tight and the big supermarkets are daily trying to outdo each other and beat Mr. Amazon into the bargain. So what price service? My regular baker is the Bakehouse in Sheringham, and I mentioned to Quinton, the baker, my wife is pre-diabetic, so what bread was best? He told me she needs GI bread, and with no more ado, it was on the shelf 2 days later. Great service, but it got better. It seems the low GI bread didn't sell too well, despite the fact prediabetes affects around 1 in 9 adults in England, over 5 million people, so it disappeared from the shelves, but disaster avoided. I asked whether regular wholemeal was okay. Don't worry, said Quinton. Let me know when you need a GI loaf and I will bake one for your wife. Now that is what I call service. And no, I wouldn't try that in your local supermarket. For the record, foods with low GI glycemic index are digested slowly and lead to a gradual steady rise in BG blood glucose levels. This means eating low GI foods as part of your diet helps to manage diabetes. Oh yes, and it has great taste too. That's Paul Milner of Sheringham.
And now here are some articles about local events and establishments to tempt you out and about in your area.
The usual hush of Norwich's Millennium Library is giving way to live music this summer as young performers fill the forum with sound as part of Read to the Beat. The free sessions held in the Connect space are taking place as part of this year's Summer Reading Challenge, which uses music as a way of encouraging children to engage with books, stories and reading for pleasure. Beth Southard, Norfolk County Council Children and Young People's Service Manager, said reading doesn't have to be a solitary, silent experience. There are lots of ways to use stories and sound together in harmony. The performances are the result of a partnership between Norfolk Libraries and Norfolk Music Hub. The weekly concerts are open to everyone and offer a chance to see some of our county's emerging musical talent. But they are also part of a wider aim to show that reading can take many forms. The Summer Reading Challenge encourages participants to create 6 reading goals of their own choosing. Those goals might involve reading with a family member, trying a recommendation from a friend, attending a library event, or setting aside time to read each day. The challenge is designed to maintain that momentum during the school holidays, when some children may read less frequently. It's free to join and rewards progress with stickers along the way before participants receive a certificate and medal on completion. Alongside the weekly music session in Norwich, libraries across the county are hosting a packed programme of story times, craft activities and family events throughout the summer. Many of our libraries are hosting lots of exciting events between now and the end of summer, Beth said. At Caister Library on August the 21st at 3:45 p.m, children can make musical instruments from recycled materials. Holt Library is hosting Musical Keys, a send-friendly music session for children aged 5 to 12 on the 24th of August at 10:30 a.m. At Thetford Library on August the 22nd, from 10:30 a.m. till 3 p.m, children aged 7 and over can help create a video game as part of the Brex Outdoor Festival. There are also lots of craft, creative and story time sessions in our libraries too. So there's something for everyone. Programmes like the Summer Reading Challenge and free access to books via the library service help to support children not only to read for pleasure over the summer holidays, but to keep books in the home all year round. There's a growing body of evidence that reading for pleasure is the most important indicator of future success for a child, Beth said. Reading for pleasure not only increases a child's reading attainment, but also leads to improvement in their writing ability, maths, vocabulary, spelling, general knowledge, understanding of other cultures, increased community participation, improved empathy and decision making. Beth hopes that this year's reading challenge will reach 10,000 local children, helping to instill a lifelong love of reading. Visit your local library and talk to staff who'll be able to sign young readers up to the Summer Reading Challenge and tell you what activities might be happening in their branch, she said. It's free to participate and all you need is a library card, which you can get in branch or by joining online. For more information, visit norfolk.gov.uk or follow the Born and Read in Norfolk campaign at tinyurl.com/BornRedNorfolk and join in on social media by using the hashtag BornAndRed2026.
The Elsham Show promises a thrilling array of family entertainment and countryside pursuits when it returns to Blickling Park later this month. Thousands of visitors are expected when the 78th annual show gets underway on Bank Holiday Monday, August 31st. Agriculture remains at the heart of the event, with extensive livestock competitions, equestrian classes, horticulture and educational exhibits celebrating Norfolk's farming community. Meanwhile, the main ring has an action-packed programme of displays and competitions. It includes the Bold Dog Freestyle Motocross Display Team, Pony Club, Mounted Games, Fancy Dress Competition, Sack Races, Farm Olympics, Livestock and Heavy Horse Parades, and subject to confirmation, a flypast by the Battle of Britain Memorial Flight. Visitors can also meet farm animals, enjoy fairground attractions and browse hundreds of trade stands, sampling the very best local food and drink. Event coordinator David Hitcham said, "We're looking forward to welcoming everyone for a really good family fun day out. We are very aware of extreme weather conditions and are making sure we are doing all we can to make sure both public and animals are treated properly." This year's show president, Susie Emmett, said, "Gates open at 8:30 a.m. on August the 31st. Adult tickets are £22 in advance and there is free entry for children aged 16 and under. Parking is free and visitors are urged to take note of any roadworks on their route to the show. For more information and advanced ticket bookings, see the elshamshow.co.uk.
Beach Life Activity Week, aimed at children and young people, will take place on the cliff tops and beach of Sheringham from Monday, August the 24th to Thursday, August the 27th. Organised by churches in Sheringham, the free event has been running since 2012 and offers a mix of games, activities and Christian teaching. Pete Skivington, organiser, said, "This is a great opportunity for the churches in Sheringham to get together to provide an exciting, fun-packed week for local families and young people, as well as for the holidaymakers who come along and join in. In the midst of all the activities, we want the youngsters to engage with Jesus and realise how he can transform their lives." The week will begin each day at 10:30 a.m. with the Beach Special at the Clifftop Marquee on the Lees, featuring drama, music, challenges and the Gunge Tank. Participants will then break into age-related Going Deeper groups to explore the daily theme. Monday afternoon will feature sand sculpture building on the beach, followed by putting at the Beeston Hills Putting Green in the evening, and an evening swim at the reef pool with inflatables. Wednesday's programme includes beach games in the afternoon and the Chiropoli Youth Trail around Sheringham in the evening. Thursday will wrap up the week with the final Going Deeper sessions, a family picnic and the beach special finale. The Beach Life team promoted the event during the Sheringham Carnival Parade, handing out sweets and flyers to the crowd. Daily registration opens at 10:15 a.m. at the Marquee on the Lees. More information is available at sheringhambeachlife.co.uk or by following Beach Life on Facebook.
A seaside town in Norfolk has been named the best spot for crabbing in the country. While nearby Cromer is famed for its crabs, writers have highlighted wells next to the sea as being the place for gillying, which is a term used for catching crabs off a pier, quay or harbour wall. With the activity being named as one of the key components of a perfect British seaside holiday, writers at The Telegraph hailed wells as the top location in the UK. In the town, it's common for visitors and locals to hunt for the crustaceans by dropping nets off the side of the harbour quay. Local businesses are mentioned, including the Little Blue Hut for its reusable crabbing kits and Wells Crab House for its platters for two. The writers also praised Great Yarmouth for its seaside charm and childhood nostalgia. They described their joy in the smells of chips and candy floss and the penny slots.
Comedy Boys is set to bring its renowned comedy night to Melton Constable Country Club. The event on Thursday, September the 3rd, promises an intimate setting for comedy enthusiasts in North Norfolk. Comedy Boys is known for its mixed bill comedy nights, featuring some of the best known names and strongest acts from the UK circuit. The show at Melton Constable Country Club will offer the same atmosphere and quality lineup, but in a smaller venue. This allows the audience to be closer to the action, creating a unique experience. The lineup for the night includes veteran comedy character Saul Bernstein, known for his show business stories, sharp one-liners, and outrageous opinions. He will be joined by Romanian comic Radu Isaac and Don Bailey, with Justin Panks hosting the night. Comedy Boys promoter Paul Dunn said people who have been to our bigger Comedy Boys nights will know the sort of atmosphere we try to create, so this is a great chance to see that same kind of show at Melton Constable Country Club in a much smaller room. Doors will open at 7 p.m. with the show starting at 8 p.m. and tickets are available for purchase from comedyboys.com.
We turn now to this week's Mardler magazine supplement, where we hear of the myths behind and a personal account of the recent solar eclipse, the efforts of volunteers in the rainforests of Sierra Leone, a technical breakdown of the sounds birds make, and an account of the book collection at Belton House.
This week's Mardler editor, Trudy Box, wrote this personal account of Wednesday evening's solar eclipse and used artificial intelligence to create background comparisons with ancient myths from around the world. Solar eclipses have always been more than astronomical events. When the moon passes in front of the sun and daylight suddenly weakens, people are reminded how dependent daily life is on the sky. Across the world, eclipses were often seen as moments when cosmic order broke down. Before astronomy explained them, many cultures imagined the sun being attacked, hidden, weakened, or used as a warning from divine powers. In ancient China, a celestial dragon was said to swallow the sun, so people beat drums or shouted to drive it away. Similarly, Vietnamese stories had a giant frog or toad. While Korean folklore told of fire dogs sent from a dark kingdom to steal the sun. In Hindu tradition, eclipses are linked with Rahu, a shadow being who swallows the sun. Because Rahu has no body, the sun soon reappears, making the eclipse a dramatic but temporary celestial conflict. Norse mythology explained wolves chasing the sun and moon. When Skoll, or High Tea, caught the sun, darkness fell. Slavic folklore told similar stories of wolves, demons, or spirits attacking or devouring the sun. In ancient Egypt, the serpent Apep, enemy of the sun god's journey, represented chaos and darkness opposing light. In Greece and Rome, eclipses were often seen as omens of disaster, war, political change, or divine displeasure. Rituals and noise-making were sometimes used to guard against harmful forces. In Mesoamerica, Mayan and Aztec traditions treated eclipses with awe and fear, connecting them with disorder, supernatural danger, or threats to balance because the sun was central to religious, agricultural, and political life. In the Andes, Inca beliefs centred on Inti, the sun god. An eclipse could signal that Inti was angry or threatened, prompting prayers, offerings, or rituals to restore harmony. Some indigenous North American traditions treated eclipses as sacred rather than merely frightening. In Navajo or Diné tradition, people might stay indoors, avoid eating or drinking, and use the time for quiet reflection and balance. In some West African traditions, eclipses were explained as a quarrel between the sun and moon. Communities might encourage reconciliation, treating the event as a call to restore harmony. Indigenous Australian and Japanese eclipse stories also varied, but often described the sun and moon interacting, hiding, or becoming linked with misfortune. Together, these traditions show how eclipses turned the sky into a powerful drama. On the Norfolk coast, where wide beaches, marshes, and open horizons make changes in light especially noticeable, such an event would feel both scientific and strangely ancient. And indeed it did on Wednesday, the 12th of August 2026, as many a Norfolk resident will have witnessed. My personal experience was as much about the anticipation of and preparation for the rare event as it was about the shared enjoyment of the spectacle itself. I arranged to meet a friend on Weybourne Beach, as we decided this would give us a quiet spot with a great view to the west. Our next concern, the best way to see the sun without looking at it directly, as this would irreversibly damage our retinas. Of course, specially designed glasses were available to purchase for those who had planned far enough ahead to get a hold of them. More last-minute choices included using a kitchen colander, the more holes the better, and a sheet of white card onto which one could project not one but several images of the newly shaped sun. Or alternatively, making a primitive pinhole camera out of a cardboard box, white paper lining, and some tinfoil in which to make the pinhole. I opted for both latter choices so that I could hedge my bets. So I drove my VW campervan to Weybourne Car Park and was already reminiscing about my teenage days and late night parties on that same beach. I had thrown some cold drinks and snacks into a basket, along with my colander and my cereal box camera, and found a parking space very close to my friend, who greeted me waving and pointing to the free space. Clearly many others had had the same idea, and the car park was nearly full, with an hour still to go until the predicted peak of the eclipse. As we locked our vehicles and took our chairs, picnics and viewing equipment to find a spot on the beach, it became apparent that many more people had also come without their cars, as the beach and the cliff tops were both awash with groups of people on chairs, blankets, grass, pebbles, standing with and without dogs and children. Everyone conveyed a great sense of wondrous anticipation through their lively chatter between groups and the sharing and comparing of the various viewing devices. It was like one giant show-and-tell session. Most groups had some kind of specialist viewing equipment, ranging from the rudimentary to the ridiculous, in the shape of a small and flimsy-looking drone, launched from very near us. I was convinced the small round flying saucer of a thing would get blown out across the North Sea and never return. I was proved wrong on that account, and I hope the owners got amazing pictures after taking the risk. At Weybourne Beach on Wednesday, we did not need a dragon myth to sense the drama. The sea seemed to dull, the birds seemed to quieten, and the low sun over the western horizon seemed briefly vulnerable as it was overshadowed by the moon. And the makeshift viewing devices came into their own. Tiny crescent-shaped sun images in the multiple and in the singular obligingly projected onto the wide cart, cloth, t-shirts and the insides of cereal packets. The old myths and modern science are different explanations, but they share the same starting point, awe at a sudden change in the natural order. So, as I drove back home along the coast road, I realised that groups just like ours at Weybourne had also gathered on the high point of Sheringham Golf Course and on Beeston Bump. They too were making their way home, and I wondered how many people across Great Britain had shared the moment when the usually delicate silvery moon upstaged the sun and became a mighty sunshield in the sky, albeit just for a few moments.
Nick Williams wrote this article for the RSPB Impact magazine, Ready for Winter 2026. Dawn breaks quickly in a rainforest. Night sounds swiftly replaced by bird calls and the hum of insects. Deep within Gola Rainforest National Park in Sierra Leone, a dedicated group is already awake. Roots checked, camp packed up and rucksacks on. They move off deeper into the forest. They are a team of rangers patrolling the 71,000 hectare park for signs of key wildlife species, as well as illegal activities such as logging or hunting. Using GPS to track progress and smartphones to record data, they will spend 8 hours under canvas. If you don't love your job, you won't do that, says Abbas, senior ranger, with a smile. Abbas and his colleagues shoulder a big responsibility. The park is home to extraordinary levels of biodiversity, including over 320 bird species, more than 600 butterflies, 12 primates, half are globally threatened on the IUCN's red list, and other endangered mammals, such as pangolins. In recognition of its outstanding value for biodiversity, in July 2025, the park was inscribed as a new UNESCO World Heritage Site, with neighbouring Tiwi Island Wildlife Sanctuary. More than 50 rangers work as part of Gola Rainforest Conservation, GRC-LG, a not-for-profit company established in 2015 between the government and the Conservation Society of Sierra Leone. The RSPB and the people of Gola's seven chiefdoms. Its mission is to protect the park and support the 122 forest edge communities that live within its 4-kilometre buffer zone. It's just after 9 a.m. and back at Gola Rainforest Conservation HQ in Kanema, the region's capital, the research and monitoring office is a hive of activity. Camera traps wait to be checked, a group of staff plan a carbon stock enhancement survey. I love being in the forest, says Mohammed, a research technician with Gola Rainforest Conservation. No noise, you only hear the sounds of nature. The survey that Mohammed and his colleagues are planning will involve research teams trekking deep into the forest to collect data on Gola's trees at specific fixed locations, so changes can be measured over time. This is vital as the results will form part of the next verification process for Gola's carbon credits. These credits fund the protection of the park and its forests, which once under pressure from commercial logging, today store around 19 million tonnes of carbon. As the site of the first REDD Plus project in West Africa, the park is a pioneer of conservation in the region. REDD Plus, reducing emissions from deforestation and forest degradation, is a UN framework for forest protection. Under the scheme, the park undergoes regular assessments to ensure its trees are being protected, so they can continue to grow and absorb carbon, as well as checking its biodiversity is conserved and its communities are supported. As afternoon arrives, the sun's glare pierces the canopy around the edges of the forest. It is here that Mariama and Bayandu are working on their cocoa farms. Both women are among more than 2,000 farmers using shade-giving trees to grow forest-friendly cocoa in areas surrounding the park. Unlike many farmers in West Africa, they are not growing on clear-cut land, but cultivate a shade-tolerant variety of cocoa with other crops, which grows among taller trees, leaving more of the forest system intact. These forested farms can support a variety of species and form links between more formally protected areas. Every year, the cocoa is exported to be turned into chocolate. In these forest edge communities, the impacts of the REDD Plus project are also felt. A benefit-sharing agreement ensures revenue from the sale of carbon credits not only funds protection of the park, but also supports local communities. This takes different forms, from training and equipping farmers to offering hundreds of secondary school scholarships every year, supporting community-based microfinance groups, and providing funding for school or medical buildings or constructing water pumps. Gola Rainforest Conservation manages these livelihood development programs and, with support from the RSPB and other partners, monitors their effectiveness. So scientific research is crucial, not only for monitoring the forest wildlife, but also for supporting its people. Evening across the forest, dusk is falling on another busy day in Gola. Rangers pitch camp, research teams finish off the day's work, farmers return home. The hum of the Kenema office softens. It is the teamwork between Gola Rainforest Conservation staff, many of whom are from forest edge communities and local communities, that makes the protection of this remarkable rainforest possible. These efforts are also supported by RSPB staff in Sierra Leone and the UK, together with other partners. Without the dedicated support of RSPB donors, we would not have been able to invest the time and resources needed to protect this extraordinary part of West Africa.
Our regular Mardler writer on all things birding and twitching, Nick Marshall, wrote this article for our listeners in July 2026. I recently wrote about some of the wonderful bird song to be heard in Norfolk during the spring and summer. When birds sing, they do so primarily to establish and defend breeding territories. But singing is only one of the types of sound which birds make. Many, for example, have alarm calls made to warn of predators or other danger. A familiar one is the blackbird, the alarm call quite unlike its mellifluous song. And what about this? Surprisingly, that rasping frog-like growl belongs to perhaps the most musical of all our birds, the nightingale. Most birds utter calls of more than one type. For example, contact calls to keep in touch when foraging in loosely formed flocks, or in huge colonies of nesting seabirds, all emitting calls which sound identical to us, but each individual being instantly recognisable to its mate or offspring. Puffins illustrate this well. Silent for most of the year when they're at sea, they become very vocal in the spring, as soon as they return to their nesting burrows. Older listeners may be reminded here of Frankie Howard. Scientific research, mainly in the United States, is now showing that some birds have specific, previously unknown calls, which are used only on migration. Warblers, for example, which generally never form flocks, will migrate together in loose flocks of different species along flyways, keeping in touch by means of contact calls only ever used for this purpose on nocturnal migration, or nocmig, as it's becoming rather inelegantly known. An example of nocmig, can often be heard in Norfolk. Go out on a clear, still night in October. Listen, and you may hear the penetrating, high-pitched seep of redwings, newly arriving here in flocks for the winter from Scandinavia and Northern Europe. Everyone knows the call of the cuckoo. Technically, it is a song, as it is just uttered by males for territorial purposes. But what is this? That is also a cuckoo, but a female. This call, known as bubbling, is not often heard and is used for contact purposes with males. It is now known that there is a third sound which both sexes of cuckoos produce only on migration, and apparently for contact purposes, which is similar to, but not the same as, the familiar sound of the male. Is there an enigma here? Why does a male cuckoo need to sing its familiar refrain to establish a territory when the territory has already been established by the host bird, whose nest the female will parasitise? The answer is that there are two territories involved, one of the host and one of the cuckoo, which the male will defend against other males to better ensure that its genes are passed on. You may be familiar with this sound, said to resemble yapping dogs. Pink-footed geese, many thousands of which spend the winter in North Norfolk. There is little more redolent of cold winter days along our coast. These birds form close-knit flocks at all times, except for the brief breeding season in the high Arctic, and these are classic contact calls used to keep the flock together. Research is now showing that bird calls are one of many factors playing a role in bird migration. Modern technology is shedding light on the great mystery of how birds are able to migrate to and from precise locations thousands of miles apart. There is much still to be discovered, and I will write more about this in a future article.
Diane Boardman wrote this article for the People's Friends magazine, edition number 273. It combines her love of books with the National Trust property of Belton House. Books are Belton's thing. This lovely Carolean English country house, built around 1685 during the reign of Charles II, is crammed with them. They're not just any old books either. Many are first editions, some in Italian and Russian. There are some very rare ones too, such as the first ever printed book of road maps. Political pamphlets from the 1600s nestle among the family's own extensive centuries-old collection, which is itself considered one of the best in the world. It's all stored in Belton's two main libraries. Books are my thing too, and it is also a passion of my two daughters, who live in far-flung corners of the country. This makes the Belton Estate in Lincolnshire a perfect central place for us to meet up for a day together. We walk through ornate wrought iron gates 3 times taller than us and into a courtyard dominated by an archway and clock tower. Then we climb up the wide stone steps of the honey and cream frontage. We are greeted at the door with a map of the house. Belton is not just about books, though. There are impressive collections of valuable art, antique silver, and old French porcelain, as well as 17th century punch bowls and a Chinese Ming Dynasty incense burner. 400 years of the Brownlow family collecting the best and most beautiful objects from around the world is on display for us to enjoy. We pass through the salon full of mirrors and furniture bearing the family coat of arms, and into the marble hall with its original floor and the finest wood carvings the 17th century has to offer. This upper ground floor contains a mix of drawing rooms, bedrooms and dressing rooms, all with delicate paper on the walls and old masters or silk tapestries for ornamentation. We admire the Windsor bedroom named after Edward VIII, but also used by our current King Charles in his RAF days. Our favourite, though, was the blue bedroom with its faded lapis blue silk, with all the rugs and carpets, family portraits and framed photographs, these rooms seemed warm and homely. We climbed to the first floor to admire the splendour of the Queen's bedroom. Next, we entered the Chinese bedroom with its original hand-painted wallpaper, before reaching the coup de grâce for us bibliophiles, the Grand Library. Originally intended as a dining room to entertain guests, it was altered in 1778 to be a drawing room, and then a century later, a library. It now houses the internationally significant collection of approximately 20,000 books. The oldest book here is one published in Germany in 1493. Our guide tells us, "You can take a seat in one of the armchairs if you wish," as we stand, overwhelmed by so many exquisite tomes. We longed to touch them, but we know we mustn't. Winding back down the plush red carpeted staircase, we find more precious books in the study on the floor below. This was the old schoolroom. It is dotted with busts of scholars like Socrates and Isaac Newton, and old globes, another enthusiasm of mine. We also loved the wooden book spines that were made to cover the shelves, supports with titles like Paradise Improved and Standstill's Travels embossed on the spines. It was impossible to tell them from the actual books by sight, and only their titles gave them away. In this room we are joined by a family on a book trail. It's just one of many entertaining games designed to keep the youngsters occupied. This game has made it possible for us to see the house, and everyone is so friendly, the mother tells us. The children have really enjoyed themselves, and we haven't even been outside to the maze or the adventure playground yet. Outside, we find a picnic table in the sunshine and we buy lunch from the cafe. Then we walk it off around the beautiful grounds of Belton Park. We visit Belton's plant shop before we leave, planning to take a souvenir cutting home for our own gardens. We are thrilled to discover it has the second-hand bookshop next door, books we can touch, buy and take home. We make our selection. They are not as rare as those in the Mansion House, but they are treasures to add to our own collection, at least.
To finish off this edition of the magazine, we have an on-the-spot report from our roving reporter, Sharon White, where she chats to the general manager of Cromer Pier.
It's Sharon White, and I'm here on the wonderful Cromer Pier with Sean Garrett, who's the general manager of the pier and the Pavilion. I'm very happy to have you talking with us today, Sean. Thank you very much.
A pleasure.
I know it's a Grade 2 listed seaside pier, and it's been a pier or jetty since 1391, but it has been destroyed by the sea several times, I think.
Yeah, definitely. The original pier was washed away. I think original piers were all made of wood and lasted for a few years, got washed away. They started to build a new one. And I think eventually when that was destroyed in around 1890, they decided that wooden piers were not really the thing and maybe we needed some metal.
Weren't going to last.
No. So they went for something a bit heavy duty. The timber was sold off for 40 quid in 1890 to make way for the pier that we know today. And the pier that we know today is a bit like Trigger's Broom. Probably not much of the original pier left, but it's been repaired so many times over the years and replaced.
I believe the seats in the theatre are original, though, aren't they?
The seats in the theatre are probably the most original part. There are some seats that are still truly original from when the theatre was originally roofed over. It's been used many times for different things. I think originally the theatre end was a bandstand. That's also been used as an ice skating rink because I think in the 20s and 30s, ice skating was the roller skating was the thing to do. And eventually they stuck a roof on it and decided to use the theatre all year round.
And I think at some point they had a very famous band of performers. What on earth were they called? The Blue Viennese Band. And apparently you had a brochure at the time that assured visitors that here, while the season lasts, strains of charming music will be constantly heard.
Yeah, we carry that theme on today. We try and get as many different varied acts to come to the pier as we can to try and appeal to everybody's taste.
And I believe for your, was it your first Christmas special experience? You got a special kind of 5-star award from the stage, wasn't it? The theatre.
Yeah, we've been lucky enough. We've been lucky enough to win quite a few awards over the town over the years. We also hope to win many more in the future.
Well, I'm sure you will. What about, I know Cromer got very popular, didn't it, when the railways and everything were coming?
Yeah, the Victorians were the ones that really made Cromer what it is today, with the onslaught of the trains coming to Cromer. That was the big turning point. I think originally the rules on using the pier were slightly different to what they are now. I think ladies were asked to retire slightly earlier than the gents were, and you weren't allowed to smoke after a certain time. So, yes.
Ladies were too delicate to have the smoking as well.
Much too delicate, yeah.
And then I believe at one point, outbreak of World War II.
Yeah, I think it was quite general with piers around the country, especially down the south and east coast, that the sections of the pier were taken out to make sure if anybody landed at one end, that they couldn't actually make it onto land.
So it was, I suppose, for the whole of the rest of the war that was like that. And then
absolutely.
And then you were looking again for people to for your season. Is it a 14-week season?
Yeah, the summer show is currently is 12 weeks. I mean, we also had other instances through the years. In the 1970s, the pier was cut in half by a very large boat that ploughed through the middle. And also in 2014, the huge storms, again, the land end of the pier was cut off, smashed away, basically.
So it's had a lot of lives, hasn't it?
That has had a lot of lives.
A bit like a
and
cat.
Been repaired a lot of times as well. Yeah.
And let's hope it keeps going. I'm sure it will, because it's so popular. It's the biggest draw, isn't it, in Cromer?
If we've got anything to do with it, that'll carry on for a lot of years.
As I say, I've been coming here for years and I love it, as does everyone.
Yeah, I've been here for 10 years now. I started as the finance manager and then 2.5 years ago I became the general manager. The pier is actually owned now by North Norfolk District Council. We lease the buildings from them. So the theatre's got approximately 500 seats in. So obviously we'd like to try and fill those seats as much as we can throughout the year, which is why we put on as many different varieties. So
You know, the comedians and all the different people we have are amazing. From Jim Davidson recently, wasn't he? I did come and see him. And Ben, Michael Jackson tribute, who I think is absolutely amazing.
We had to put 2 shows on for Ben.
Because
he was so popular. Yeah. Sold both of them out. It's incredible. We're really lucky here. We've got a lot of acts come to see us that wouldn't probably usually come to such a small venue, but we've built up quite a good rapport with a lot of acts and they do come time and time again.
Well, it's special to everyone, I think, yeah, isn't it, once you've been?
And we had, for instance, last week, we had the likes of Bradley Walsh and Joe Pasquale pop in to see the summer show just on their afternoon off, didn't have anything to do, so popped down to Cromer.
Bradley had done many seasons himself, hadn't he, I believe.
Bradley always said that because he started his first professional gig in Cromer, he would end his.
And I know you've got some other sort of different sorts of things as well, haven't you?
Yeah, we've also started it last year. We did summer sessions, which was literally Saturday night, a DJ out on the deck, which has proved so popular this year, last year, that this year, we on the 25th of July, we're going to start Friday nights with the sunset sessions, 7 till 10. And it is literally a case of coming down, grabbing a drink and listening to the music.
Come along and listen. And that's free, isn't it, I think?
Absolutely free. The Friday night sunset sessions are a little bit more energetic music-wise. All age groups love them.
Absolutely,
We do on a Sunday after the 27th of July onwards, for 7 weeks, we're going to have a chilled-out session.
Oh, that sounds good.
So they'll be from 5 till 8 p.m. Similar thing, DJ outside, but the music will not be anywhere near as energetic.
No.
So hopefully, but that'll be just as popular as...
And then there's something else that's coming up. Is it the Norfolk Heritage Open Day?
This is something that we started last year. We were asked to be included. The Heritage Day is literally all over the UK, and it's designed to give people the experience of something that they wouldn't normally see when they go to a heritage location. So last year, as our starting event, as a nod back to the original use of the pier, we had the Sheringham and Cromer Brass Band out on the front.
Oh, right, lovely.
Because the pier originally had a bandstand for people to come and listen to the music. So we did that. And this year we're going to hopefully look at expanding that slightly to give people a backstage experience so they can come and have a look around.
And I believe your charity of the year that you're supporting.
Guide Dogs UK is our charity this year.
Yeah, excellent.
Which they do a brilliant job. So we try and raise as much money as
well. Thank you so much. And I know our listeners are going to be really, really interested. And hopefully some of them will be able to come along to your, if not a show, the sessions.
Yeah, we'd like to extend the hand and hope everybody come, to come and see the summer show or the Christmas.
Thanks.
Okay.
Thanks ever so much, Sean. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And those items conclude this week's magazine supplement. Our thanks go to the authors of these articles for their contributions.
Returning to the news, our penultimate selection of news stories cover nature and climate issues.
Keats called it the season of mists and mellow fruitfulness in his much-loved Ode to the Autumn. But a far less poetic kind of seasonal change is on the way, as drought and heatwaves scorch our landscape. For the leaves are turning brown in what experts call a false autumn, triggered by the continuing high temperatures and prolonged dry spell, as thirsty trees battle to survive. Steve Collin, Nature Conservation Manager with the Norfolk Wildlife Trust, said, "Broadleaf trees lose water through their leaves. When the roots of the trees detect very dry conditions, some trees deliberately shed their leaves early. This reduces the amount of water they lose, which helps them survive the drought. Beech and birch are particularly quick to do this, and so they can start to look autumnal surprisingly early." Mr. Collins said if leaves turn brown and fall off as they would in the autumn, this is usually a sign that the tree is coping with the dry weather. But scorched leaves can be a sign that the tree is struggling more seriously with the lack of water, and while a tree can usually cope with doing this in one very dry year, shedding its leaves early year after year can weaken it. Here in the East, climate change is likely to mean far more frequent periods of both drought and high temperatures in the future, said Mr. Collin. This means our trees and the multitude of wildlife that rely on them are facing a serious threat. But trees can also be part of the solution. They store carbon, provide shade and cooling, help keep moisture in the landscape, and create cooler, more sheltered places for people and wildlife. So to help our trees, along with our wildlife and communities, we need more trees. By putting the right trees in the right places, we can create a more resilient landscape, better able to cope with a changing climate. Mark Gush, Head of Environmental Horticulture at the Royal Horticultural Society, said, "It's certainly happening. We're into heatwave number 5 now. We're seeing very extreme conditions." He said plants were closing the pores in their leaves to reduce excessive water loss, which would also reduce the cooling effect, leaving foliage prone to becoming scorched by the sun, while trees would begin to shed their leaves. He added, while the leaves would not turn green again in the event of rain, new ones would sprout if wet weather arrives soon. Shallow-rooted trees, such as birch, hawthorn and hornbeam, are most vulnerable, whilst deeper-rooted oaks are better equipped to weather the drought. Autumn starts on September the 1st, according to the Met Office, and runs until the start of winter on November 30th. But the start of the so-called astronomical autumn begins with the autumn equinox, when day and night are nearly equal, which falls this year on September the 23rd. Or as John Keats, 1795 to 1821, put in his celebrate ode penned in 1819, "Season of mists and mellow fruitfulness, close bosom friend of the maturing sun, conspiring with him how to load and bless with fruit the vines that round the thatch eaves run, to bend with apples the mossed cottage trees, and fill all fruit with ripeness to the core, to swell the gourd and plump the hazel shells with a sweet kernel, to set budding more, and still more later flowers for the bees, until they think warm days will never cease, for summer has o'erbrimmed their clammy cells."
A family have issued a warning to others after a woman suffered a suspected adder bite in Norfolk. July Rusted from Cambridge had been staying at her mother's holiday home in Waxham last month. She had been walking through a field close to the beach when she felt a sharp pain before returning home. Having got home, Mrs. Rusted went to rest on the couch and said she began to feel unwell. "Her condition quickly worsened," says Mrs. Rusted's mother, Yvonne Goldsmith. "She began vomiting heavily and her legs and lips started to swell," she explained. "Her leg had also started bruising heavily. Mrs. Rusted was taken by ambulance to the James Paget Hospital, where she underwent testing before eventually being released. Her family say they initially thought she may have been stung by a bee or wasp. However, they found two dots at the source of the pain on the heel of Mrs. Rusted's foot. Despite being sent home, her condition continued to worsen the following day. Her leg ballooned in size, Ms. Goldsmith said. You could barely see her toes, and her leg was turning a dark purple colour, almost black. Following another trip to the hospital, Mrs. Rusted eventually decided the best course of action was to return home to Cambridge, where she saw specialists treat her for a suspected adder bite. Last week, Waxham Sands Holiday Park issued a warning to beachgoers to watch for the serpents in the dunes on the beach. However, Ms. Goldsmith has urged people to watch their step further afield. She says her daughter was bitten while walking through a nearby field, as well as thanking Waxham Sands Holiday Park staff for their help during the incident. Mrs. Rusted is still recovering from her ordeal, with her swelling reducing significantly but still being monitored.
While fish have been dying amid the drought, which has swept across Norfolk, one species is benefiting from the heat wave. Some butterflies are enjoying the dry conditions, which have engulfed the Broads this summer. Norfolk has been among the hottest places in the country, with temperatures reaching 38 degrees in Lingwood in June. And Broads Authority officials say the rivers and wetlands have been unable to escape the effects of the searing temperatures. The severe impact has been so widespread that the healthy butterflies have been one of the few positives from a difficult summer. The species need the sun to warm up their muscles so they are able to fly. Authorities have had to clear thousands of dead fish from the River Wensum, with oxygen levels lower in waterways as a result of the drought conditions. Officials say there are low water levels and river flows on the Yare, Wensum and Waveney rivers, meaning there is less water for birds, mammals and aquatic species. There has also been an increase in blue-green algae on waterways on the Broads, concentrated particularly around Ranworth and South Walsham. The bacteria contains toxins that are highly poisonous and can be fatal to pets. Conservation work on the Broads' open fens has also been delayed due to the drought. The heat wave means officials are not able to burn sedge, a grass-like plant which grows in wet soils and marshland. As a result of the delays, the BA has been left with significant amounts of sedge to dispose of later in the year. Despite the wildlife damage, bosses say trade and business bookings have increased. A spokeswoman said the visitor sector has benefited from the fine and dry weather, with many businesses reporting a healthy increase in bookings and good trade over the summer. The Broads Authority's own visitor information centres, yacht stations and boat trips have reported increased numbers over recent years.
A rare bird has been spotted on the Norfolk Broads in an unusual summer sighting. The black stork was seen at Hickling Broad on Friday, August the 7th, by wildlife photographer and Norfolk Wildlife Trust volunteer Nick Goodrum, who was visiting the site with his wife. While sitting in the secker hide, he spotted a large, dark bird and suspected it was the black stork that had recently been reported in the Horsey, Winterton and Higham Holmes areas. Mr. Goodrum said, "This bird is obviously a juvenile as it has a grey bill and legs, whereas a mature adult has a red bill and legs." He managed to photograph the bird as it fed along the water's edge. "Once I processed the photos, I showed my fellow colleagues at Hickling the next day to confirm my identification," Mr. Goodrum added. The black stork is classified as a rare vagrant in the UK and is typically recorded in fewer than 1% of bird sightings, according to the British Trust for Ornithology. Sightings are more common in spring and autumn, so summer sightings usually involve wandering juveniles or continental migrants.
And finally, our last few articles.
Students at Sheringham Sixth Form are celebrating their A-level results, marking the last results day for the institution following the announcement of its closure. This year, 10% of grades were awarded at A-star to A, while 28% achieved A star to B and 53% secured A star to C. Overall, 90% of students achieved grades A star to E. 5 students were also named Norfolk Scholars. The results come after 2 years of A-level study and represent the final cohort at Sheringham Sixth Form, which has closed to new pupils. The Synergy Multi-Academy Trust said the decision had been made because of low uptake, with only around 50 pupils enrolled. In an email shared by the Trust's Chief Executive, Alistair Ogle, it said a sixth form needs at least 100 students in each year group to be financially viable under Department for Education guidance. Don Hollidge, Head of School, said, "The cohort achieved the highest A-level average point score seen over the past 3 years, reflecting the strong progress made by students throughout their sixth form journey. In addition, the school's value-added measure improved significantly compared with 2025. We're incredibly proud of our students and all they have achieved. These results reflect their hard work, determination and commitment, supported every step of the way by our dedicated staff and families. We look forward to seeing our students move on to university, apprenticeships and employment, and wish them every success for the future. Meanwhile, Reefham College said its results reflected the hard work, determination and ambition of students. Sarah Steele, College Director, said, "Building on achieving the highest progress out of all A-level providers in Norfolk last year, students at Reefham College are celebrating even greater success. Our students have achieved excellent results and deserve enormous credit for their hard work and commitment. We're incredibly proud of the determination and resilience they have shown throughout their studies. These results reflect their ambition and the effort they have put into achieving their goals. Our students leave Reefham College as capable, mature and well-rounded young people, ready to embrace the opportunities ahead. We are extremely proud of all they have achieved and wish them every success for the future."
A creative Instagram post has won a student a competition at a major Norfolk fruit farm. Mia, a Year 8 student at Broadland High Ormiston Academy in Hoverton, was named the winner of a competition run by Place UK, a leading fruit grower based in Tunstead. The site grows British berries and rhubarb and is a leading supplier of individually frozen beans, pulses, pasta and grains for supermarkets, restaurants, food manufacturers and grocers. The company challenged students to design a social media post promoting careers in agriculture. Six finalists were invited to tour the site, present their ideas to the management team and explore the farm's operations, including its use of data-driven crop management and advanced robotics. Matt Smith, co-managing director at Place UK, said, "The agri-food and agri-tech sector is a pillar of the local economy, and as one of the UK's leading growers, helping Norfolk-grown produce reach kitchens across the country, we're passionate about showcasing the fantastic opportunities it can offer for young people starting their careers. With developing technologies such as AI and advancing robotics, it's a growing and evolving sector waiting for an injection of energy and ideas from tomorrow's young minds. We hope their visit and tour gave them an exciting insight into what it's like to work on a large commercial farm and hopefully inspired more to pursue roles in agriculture." Mia's winning post impressed judges with its creative approach and focus on Place UK's supportive working environment. The competition forms part of Place UK's ongoing partnership with the School to support careers education and raise awareness of opportunities in the agricultural sector. The company now plans to become an enterprise employer through the Norfolk and Suffolk Careers Hub, offering students hands-on workplace experiences and helping teachers connect classroom learning to real-world career pathways. Simon Laycock, Vice Principal at Broadland High, said, "We're excited to be working with Place UK and other local employers to inspire our students and make them aware of the wide range of jobs in our region."
Crowds enjoyed 2 days of summer fun as a much-loved seaside carnival got fully underway at the weekend. Cromer Carnival 2026 got into full swing with family activities, entertainment and traditional competitions across the town. The weekend ended with the crowning of Miss Cromer, with actor and comedian Joe Tracini taking centre stage for the Sunday ceremony. Mr. Tracini crowned Naomi Bushell as Miss Cromer 2026 in front of a large crowd on the Cromer Pier forecourt. Carnival Sunday also saw a church service, a procession through the town, and the crowning of other members of the Carnival Royal Party. Long-standing competitions delighted audiences and participants. Monty McEwen won the Bonnie Baby contest and took home the Tom Bolton Trophy. David Loudon claimed first place in the Knobbly Knees competition. Leslie Osborne was named Glamorous Grandmother. Melissa Eyre won the children's fancy dress competition dressed as a ballerina. Beyond the contests, the carnival field offered classic vehicles, crafts, and other attractions. Events continue until Friday.
A six-day trip to Bavaria has strengthened international friendships and cultural ties. Members of the North Walsham Town Twinning Association recently returned from a visit to Friesenried, their twin town in Germany, enjoying a packed itinerary and warm hospitality. Despite regional heat waves, Steve Wolstenholme, chairman of the association, said, "As ever, one is never hungry in Friesenried." The generosity and hospitality of our hosts were second to none. Town twinning offers a fantastic opportunity to build international friendships, experience rich cultural traditions, and create lifelong memories. The group visited Hohenpeissenberg, home to Bavaria's oldest mountain weather station, explored the towns of Murnau and Ettal Abbey, and took a scenic cable car ride up the 2,000-metre Alpspitze. They also spent a day in Munich, with the option of a guided tour of the historic city centre or a visit to the football stadium. During a joint committee meeting, delegates reviewed the success of the exchange and confirmed provisional dates for a return visit to North Walsham, scheduled for May the 20th to the 25th in 2027.
British people may love a queue. However, in Cromer, that tradition has led to frustration being voiced over a new policy at one of the town's landmarks. Cromer Pier has brought back its free sunset sessions, with tighter security and capacity controls following disruption at an event last month. But while pier bosses said the first night under the new arrangements was managed safely and effectively, one local said the restrictions led to people leaving disappointed. Cromer Pier had suspended their twice-weekly free music sessions after police were called to the pier after reports that a large group of teenagers was acting aggressively towards event staff. The events have reopened with new rules. Under-18s must be accompanied by an adult, bag checks will be carried out, and only alcohol purchased on the pier can be consumed. One local said the new capacity limitations were ineffective at deterring people arriving, leading to massive queues. Operating a one-in, one-out policy meant people gave up and left disappointed, they added. Tourists and locals were denied access to the pier, which is not what we want in our little seaside town famed for its traditional charms. A statement from Cromer Pier bosses said, "The capacity limit does inevitably mean that once we are full, some people may be disappointed if they are unable to gain entry. However, from an operational and safety perspective, we were very comfortable with how the evening was managed and the measures gave us much greater control over numbers and the overall environment. The same arrangements will continue for upcoming events."
Campaigners are urging North Norfolk District Council to examine whether future house building in Hoveton could worsen pressure on Wroxham Bridge and local air quality. Their call comes during the Council's local plan scoping consultation, which is seeking views on the evidence needed for a replacement plan. Broad's Bulletin, an online community group, says further growth in Hoveton must be assessed across the North Norfolk Broadland boundary because Hoveton and Wroxham function as one settlement. It said the bridge is already a key traffic pinch point and wants the council to consider road capacity, possible mitigation and developer funding before homes are built. The group also said Hoveton should be specifically included in air quality work, pointing to historic nitrogen dioxide concerns near Wroxham Bridge. Campaigners say the adopted local plan increased Hoveton's allocation from 160 to 240 homes, while a requirement for developer contributions towards a Wroxham and Hoverton network improvement strategy was removed during examination. They contrast this with North Walsham, where specific highway works were identified to address traffic effects in Coltishall. North Norfolk District Council has been asked whether it accepts the concerns, what transport and air quality evidence it holds, and whether it will include the issues in its new local plan. The scoping consultation closes on August 31st.
A proposed campsite by Cromer has been given the go-ahead more than 6 weeks after its intended opening date. Hannant campsite has been permitted up to 14 pitches at Pine Tree Farm on Norwich Road until August the 31st this year, with just over 2 weeks of its summer season remaining. North Norfolk District Council found that the campsite could cause disruption to wildlife, but still gave the green light after the applicant paid £44.18 towards a county-wide mitigation scheme. The decision followed a habitats regulation assessment, but the council said the impact could be addressed through a payment into Norfolk's Green Infrastructure Recreation Avoidance and Mitigation Strategy, known as GIRAMS. The scheme is intended to fund measures aimed at reducing visitor pressure on sensitive habitats. The operator selected a one-year GIRAMS subscription covering January the 1st to December the 31st, 2026, and the £44.18 charge has been paid. The decision means up to 14 standard-sized pitches, each measuring 5 metres by 9 metres, can be stationed on the land during the summer period.
A wandering goose has become an unlikely local celebrity after repeatedly popping up around a Norfolk coastal village. The feathered visitor, affectionately dubbed Gary, or possibly Bob, depending on who you ask, has been spotted roaming between Sandy Gull's Caravan Park and Kiln Cliffs Caravan Park in Munsley. He even walked into someone's caravan. Gary has also tried his luck at a summer job after he was spotted wandering into a workshop in Gimmingham. Holidaymaker Kimmy Bennett Abbess said she was delighted to meet the goose during a visit to Kiln Cliffs with her family. "He's been there nearly every day making odd trips to Sandy Gulls," she said. "He looks in good health." The goose's visits have proved a particular surprise for Kimmy's grandmother Doreen Abbess, 101, who has been going to Kiln Cliffs for more than 75 years. But after decades of seaside memories, it may be Munsley's newest resident who is now stealing the show. A local has contacted Wildlife Rescue to find out where Gary came from and whether he has an owner.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of The Mardler, with readings from the North Norfolk News. If you have any comments or queries, you can contact our listener liaison officer, Imogen Waterstone, on 01263 587 610.
Perhaps we should just mention that if you have a smartphone, tablet or computer, or know someone who has, you can listen to this and other editions online at mardler.org.uk. You can also use an Alexa smart speaker, a variety of smartphone apps, or even a telephone call to listen. Find out the details on our website, mardler.org.uk.
We rely on receiving your returned memory sticks and pouches so that we can continue to send you new editions each week. So please remember to return the pouch and memory stick promptly, making sure to reverse the address label first.
The sound engineer today was Daniel Butterworth. Editing and producing this issue was Trudy Box. Our colleagues in the copying and dispatch room join us in wishing you the best of health, and we look forward to joining you again in a week's time. But for now, it's
cheerio!